Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Haunted houses. Some people love them.
It's alive!
Others do not.
Here's Johnny!
Halloween is a $9 billion industry in the U.S., and every year, haunted houses across New England attract people who want to be scared or to conquer their fear. So why do some of us love to be scared? And what does it take to scare us good? Joining us in Studio 3 is Skip Dillon, president of both Wicked Amusements and Chambers of Terror in Salem. Skip, hello.
Welcome to myself.
And thank you
so much for having me.
I thought you were going to welcome me to the horror already. I don't want to be scared.
not just yet.
Also joining us on the line from Burlington, Vermont, is Tony Magistrale. He's a professor at the University of Vermont, where he teaches English and film, and he's written about Gothic horror, Edgar Allan Poe, Stephen King. He also researched the history of the haunted house for Stephen King, which raises your cred even higher. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good evening.
Excellent.
Oh, now he's just going to show me up.
All right. Now listen.
We can both play that game, you know.
This is going to be good, y'all. But before we start with our panel, I want to join the conversation. Call us. What scares you? What is your favorite way to scare yourself on Halloween? And are there some experiences that are better or worse for you? Join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, so I'm going to ask you both the same question to start. Skip, I'll go to you first. How did you become a scare expert?
Well, as I generally describe myself, I grew up a theatrical jack of all trades and master of maybe 2.5. And when I was 19 years old, I started working at a haunted attraction called Terror on the Wharf in Salem, Massachusetts, which just happens to be located in the exact same building and location that my attraction is located in now, 25 years later. And I immediately fell in love with the production, the design, the creation of these attractions, despite the fact that when I was a child, I was terrified by haunted houses. I did not like horror movies. It is something that I grew into as an adult when I got the chance to actually scare people myself.
All right, Tony, how about you? You are an expert in sort of the history of the scare. How did that come about?
Well, the first thing I want to ask Skip is if I could have a guided tour of his amusement.
Yeah,
awesome.
I'll drive to Salem and you can give me a tour.
Whenever you like, sir.
We will hook you guys up with contact information for each other after the segment, because I would love to know that happened.
Very cool. I came at things from a very different angle than Skip just described. Skip has this empirical relationship to horror. For me, it was all academic. What happened was I had a professor when I was an undergraduate who was an expert in the Gothic, and I took several courses with him and began to realize that the Gothic was not just about, freaky stuff that was going on in Halloween, but also that it was this amazing strain that ran through some of the great literature of the last three centuries, for instance.
So, Skip, I want to pick up on that for a second, something Tony just said. He talked about the great literature. Here's one of the things that's interesting. So many people love horror. They love to be scared. They love haunted houses. And yet it consistently has this lowbrow reputation. Right. And I don't understand that, because people rely on it for a key piece of life. So how do we explain that we almost sort of resent or put down the things that we do for this essence of fear and thrill?
I think that because it is tied into that reflexive adrenaline rush, dopamine release, nature of thrill attractions in general, that it is such a reflexive, instinctive response. It is a base response, an animalistic response.
Interesting.
And I think that it is not a terribly cerebral thing at its core essence. And that's why people have a tendency to maybe look down on it as not being something that's elevated to the degree that it should be, frankly.
So, Tony, to Skip's point, we talked with Dr. Marnie Chanoff, a psychiatrist who's on faculty at Harvard Medical School, and McLean, we wanted to physiologically understand what's happening when a person experiences fear. Here she is.
Part of the response is a sense of arousal in the body on a physical level. So, you know, your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure goes up, you feel very alive and engaged. People feel like they are really kind of in the body and experiencing the full capacity of the body, and which some people don't feel all that often. You know, they get surges of those stress hormones, but also dopamine, which can feel very pleasurable for some people who can tolerate it. So there's a whole surge of neurotransmitters and hormones that get evoked.
So there's a lot going on there, and we haven't always had the kinds of technologies that Skip may have available to him today, Tony, to bring that out. And yet throughout history, we have found ways to strike terror in others' hearts. Well, you know, where does that come from? How do we do it in the old days?
Well, I just want to address where the focus of horror came, of modern horror came in the 18th century, because here you've got this great dichotomy that's created in the 18th century. The 18th century is known as the Age of Enlightenment. It was the era of reason and rationality. The great Americans that put together the Constitution were all deists, were all rational people. Jefferson, Ben Franklin. It was the age of science. Chemistry, physics was born in the 18th century. But careful, because as you get closer to the end of the century, the lights go out in the Enlightenment. And what takes over is the haunted house. It begins in about 1763 with the Castle of Otranto. And then when you get to the last decade of the 18th century, you've got not only the revolutions in France and the United States, but you've also got literally hundreds of Gothic texts that are produced in the 1790s.
So,
and that's designed not to take you to a place of rationality, but to take you to a place of, you know, what we've been talking about here, visceral physical response.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Have you been to a haunted house yet this year? Have you been to Skip's haunted house yet this year? Are you reading Gothic horror? What do you like to do to scare yourself? Or are you like me? Do you want to do nothing to scare yourself because you hate being scared? Give us a call. Skip, so Tony just took us back hundreds of years. There's that old adage that the more things change, the more they stay the same. Is scaring people through, you know, a haunted house any different today than it was hundreds of years ago?
I would say that what has been elevated in the last 25 years is primarily the immersive production value of these attractions. The core fundamental design psychology behind scaring people has not changed, because what scares people has not changed. And so the most effective attractions out there from a scare perspective are primarily tapping into xenophobia, fear of things that are foreign to us, things that are unknown to us. In our attraction, we like to use non-humanoid morphologies for our characters, because that is a distressing thing when you see something that is insectoid or
a
lamprey-mouthed ghoul come out of the corner and then retract into the darkness. The more that they can recognize and find a basis of relevance to the less that they're generally scared of it. However, it is worth noting that while 25 years ago, these attractions were mainly the domain of the 4-H clubs and the JCs and other charity organizations,
local
churches, churches in the Southwest doing the Hell House type of attraction and whatnot. As you said, it is now a industry that makes billions and billions of dollars per year. And you can go into your local Home Depot or at a temporary Spirit Halloween store and purchase props that 25 years ago would have cost thousands and thousands in custom fabrication for a couple $100s and deck your entire house out. So that has certainly escalated the expectations of the customer base in terms of they want to see a Disney quality immersive environment attraction and walkthrough
movie. Does that make it harder for you to keep up?
It makes it certainly something that requires a different level of production expertise, a different level of investment, certainly fiscally in these attractions. But ultimately, at the end of the day, if you design an attraction efficiently and you understand what scares people and you have the right actors, and I can't underscore that enough, then the attraction is going to be a good haunted house.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Gordon from Shirley, you are on the line. What's on your mind?
It seems like so many horror movies and horror novels focus on one kind of threat to the human being. Physical safety comes into play. But there are so many other kinds of things that are truly horrible that never sort of make it into the genre of movies and novels. For example, fear of cancer, fear of losing all your money, or let's take it up a real big notch to being hauled off in the Holocaust on the night of Kristallnacht. There are some threats to real people's lives that are truly horrible, but that don't make it into this genre of entertainment.
Thanks for raising that, Gordon. And Tony, I'm going to turn to you. You know, as Gordon said those things, I have to admit, I got goosebumps on my neck, that my hair stood up. I got a feeling of dread. But I also thought it would feel wrong to seek fear via entertainment using subjects like that. Is there a history behind that or a perspective that you can provide?
Yeah, I think it's really important to distinguish the various levels of terror that that we experience aesthetically and that we experience through literature, through art, through music, and even through film. On one level, there is that, you know, that terrifying somebody's in the basement or don't look into that closet, that visceral fear. But there's also always that an element of the psychological that's at work. This is what made Poe so great in the 19th century, is that Poe, there are very few supernatural events that occur in Poe's fiction. Most of it is all about the mind unraveling or the mind under duress. And I think that's part of what the caller, the person who just left that message, Gordon, was referring to, that human beings are, let's face it, we are extraordinarily vulnerable at the same time as we're resilient.
Yeah. 1-800, sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I think it's that vulnerability that makes also, this is what's so ironic, it makes for great art, too.
Yeah. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jordan's on the line from Cambridge. Jordan, jump in.
Hi. I just wanted to say, I go to haunted houses every year. It's actually not my favorite thing to do, but my partner likes to do it. I think all haunted houses, or at least the ones I've experienced, do the startled tactic. And it seems kind of old and redundant. It works. I'm scared. My heart rate is up. But I'd also like to see something new.
So thanks for that call, Jordan. Skip, I mean, you're in the industry. What's new? What's coming next? What's the cutting edge?
I think that I'd like to certainly address the prevalence of jump scares in attractions. And there's a reason that the jump scares are there. One is that it is certainly a blanket thing that works very effectively. And two, frankly, is that it is conducive to throughput. And at the end
meaning
of the day,
churning people
yeah,
through
at the end of the day, haunted attractions have to move people through at a certain rate, put a certain number of people into the front scene and move them through. every couple of minutes or whatever the case may be. And the larger the attraction, so if you take the scale of a Scream Park attraction or a Universal Studios attraction, they need to just move people through almost in a conga line, double or triple file. And unfortunately, what that does is it removes the ability to set up more cerebral scares, to play with the audience as much. At my attraction in Salem, it is a very small attraction, as all the attractions are, and we don't worry as much about throughput there. And so we are able to stage scares and psychological effects that, you know, which is not to say that we don't use jump scares, because we certainly do. But to just throw one quick example out, in the first room of my attraction, the guests are greeted by a guide character who has a lantern. And the guide character, after getting a scare in on them, makes them realize that they have to follow him, follow the light of that lantern. And then they are abandoned by that character later.
I would never do that.
You see the reaction that you have.
I'm not even there.
And then later in the attraction, they're picked back up by that guide character again.
Oh, my God.
And then they are abandoned a second time and made to walk into an area that is pitch black.
Yeah.
No lighting. They have to feel their way through. And as you might imagine, the walls are covered in disconcerting textures and wet things, you know, that are off-putting. And these are not new technologies by any means, but it's something that we're able to do because we don't have the throughput requirements that a larger attraction would.
So, Tony, that it's awful. Why are you and I both laughing, right?
Well,
why are we laughing?
Well, because first of all, I'm thinking when that guide comes and connects with you and skips attraction the second time, that guide's also a psychotherapist.
Yes.
You know, to sit down with you and say, okay, let's talk about what you've been through.
Is that right, Skip?
Not so much. They're bringing them into the graveyard of spiders, which is an arachnophobe's worst nightmare, to be sure. But certainly they are baiting them with a false sense of security, and they should know better because they already should know to distrust that character at that point. But they are so grateful to have the light of that lantern again.
Hey, let's take one more call. We've got Nora from Marblehead on the line. Nora, go ahead.
Hi. I was actually an actress in a literary haunted house at the House of the Seven Gables in Salem. Oh. We are putting on two shows every weekend in October leading up to Halloween. In one, we're telling the legacy of the Hanging Judge, Nathaniel Hawthorne's ancestor. And the one I was in is a retelling of the story of the House of the Seven Gables. And I think the scariest thing in that getup is the audience, when they come in fully masked and you're acting in front of them like just 3 yards away and you have no idea what's going on in their faces.
Thanks for that, Nora, because I don't think, Skip, that anyone thinks about whether or not the people putting on the scare are ever uncomfortable or scared.
Absolutely. It is a risky profession. There is a ingrained fight or flight response in people. And then you have folks that do come through looking to cause trouble. And while we do our best to sort those people out in line with security, sometimes it just happens accidentally. We had one of my actors was given a bloody nose by a young woman completely accidentally. She had that reflection. Reflexive, uncontrollable physical response to throw her hand out, and I had to sit down with him afterwards as he was icing his nose and filling out the incident report and say, hey, you know, you did a great job, and that's why that happened.
Congratulations. Yeah. All right, so go ahead,
Tony. The horror came back to you, Skip, like, oh, no, you're going to sue me.
No.
So, Tony, I want to we've only got a couple minutes left, and so I'm going to give short shrift to this, but I do want to ask you to address the difference between that which is scary and that which is deeply disturbing. And how do we think about the line between those things? I'll just leave it there.
Well, I'm thinking of the incident that Skip just described, and I'm thinking of the fact that, you know, here you've got a massive group of people going through a house or going through an amusement, and there's a mixture of fear and humor that's going on. People are in good spirits, and they know that they're going to be scared, and that creates all sorts of mixed receptors that are going off. But what happens when suddenly a true freak, a true ghoul comes into that scene and decides to cause chaos? That's when the joy of terror, the joy of horror, turns into something truly disturbing.
What I think I've no, please
we've
go
seen,
ahead.
We've seen a lot of that in school shootings every day in this country. You know, where suddenly there's this abrupt experience where kids are terrified.
Yeah.
There's nothing joyous about that. That's just horror in its purest form.
Well, I hate to end on that note, but we actually need to. That's Tony Magistrale. He's a professor at the University of Vermont, where he teaches English and film. And we also have Skip Dillon, president of both Wicked Amusements and Chamber of Terror in Salem. Thanks to both of you, Skip and Tony.
And a thank you to you, too.
It was our pleasure.
Awesome. Awesome. That is our show for today. And can I just say, I love my job. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.